Well, welcome, my friends, to The Catholic Reason, a radio production of St. Michael Catholic Radio, based here in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, where we think through various claims made by the Catholic Church concerning issues of faith, morality, and culture, and provide reasons behind those claims. I'm Dr. Carlo Broussard, staff apologist and speaker for Catholic Answers at Catholic.com, and a member of the Chancery Evangelization Team here at the Diocese of Tulsa in eastern Oklahoma. The Catholic Reason airs locally here in Tulsa every Thursday from 4 to 5 p.m., 94.9 and 102.9 St. Michael Catholic Radio. But you may be listening on your own local Catholic radio station at a different time, since The Catholic Reason is now aired on other Catholic stations throughout the country. So if you're listening outside the Tulsa area, welcome and thanks for joining me. Note that you can download the show through whichever podcast platform that you use by subscribing to the Eastern Oklahoma Catholic Podcast. That's the Eastern Oklahoma Catholic Podcast. You can also access the archived episodes at carlobroussard.com under the audio tab. In today's episode, we're going to look at challenges to the early papacy. The claim that the Pope is the universal shepherd of the Church rests upon the historical claim that the Bishop of Rome succeeded Peter in that bishopric. But some Protestants challenge that foundational belief and argue that the evidence suggests the Church of Rome wasn't even governed by a monarchical bishop, that is to say, a single bishop, in the first and second centuries. And given that there wasn't a single bishop of Rome in the early church, well, then the Catholic claim about the papacy must not be true. Now, there are a few reasons why Protestants think this, and we're going to look at two of those reasons in today's episode. So let's consider the first. We're just going to dive right in here. The letter of Clement to the Church of Corinth, which dates to the latter part of the first century, is often appealed to as evidence that the Church of Rome, and by way of implication, the Bishop of Rome, had a posture of leadership relative to the other churches within the Christian world. Since the letter is sent to the Church of Corinth to settle certain disputes they were having in response to the Church of Corinth's request for the Church of Rome to intervene. But some Protestants argue that the letter doesn't speak in the first person singular, which is what we'd expect if the letter was being issued by Clement, the Bishop of Rome, which history tells us was who was the third successor to St. Peter as the Bishop of Rome, or the fourth Bishop of Rome, the fourth Pope. Rather, so it's argued, the letter uses the first person plural we. For example, the letter states this: owing, dear brethren, to the sudden and successive calamitous events which have happened to ourselves, we feel that we have been somewhat tardy in turning our attention to the points respecting which you consulted us. Moreover, many have argued that Clement wasn't even the Bishop of Rome when this letter was written. When Catholics appeal to this letter as evidence for leadership of the Bishop of Rome, it's often assumed that Clement wrote this letter as Bishop of Rome towards the end of the first century, about AD 90 to 96. But Clement wasn't bishop until AD 90, right? And so this letter, it's argued, was written before the destruction of the temple in AD 70. Clement, therefore, would have been a secretary of sorts in the Roman Church. The reason for this early dating of the letter is that Clement speaks of the temple as if it were still standing in chapter 41 of his letter. For some Christians, these two details indicate the early Church of Rome wasn't governed by a single bishop, like the papacy would demand, but rather was governed by a council of presbyters or priests. So again, you take into the consideration that this letter was probably written, the letter speaks in the first person plural we, and that the letter was written prior to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, when Clement wasn't even Bishop of Rome, that would seem to indicate that there's no single Bishop of Rome at the time this letter was written, and that the Church of Rome was governed by a council of presbyters. Now, there are two approaches that we can take here. One is negative, and the other is positive. So let's start with the negative approach first. The use of we, the first person plural, doesn't prove the letter is issued by a council of elders or presbyters and not a single bishop, right? So again, it's sort of a negative approach. We're trying to show that you can't conclude council of elders and no single bishop based on the premise the letter speaks in first person plural we. Okay, that's basically our claim here. Notice the objection assumes that a council of presbyters is the only explanation of the use of we. So their line of reasoning is, if the use of we, then council of presbyters. But that's not necessarily true, right? As I already mentioned, some scholars believe that Clement wrote this letter during the time when he was merely a presbyter in the Church of Rome and writes it as a secretary. This being the case, Clement's use of we doesn't disprove a single bishop of Rome any more than a papal secretary's use of we or the Vatican would disprove the existence of a current bishop of Rome when he writes about the Vatican's take on an issue. So we can show that this line of reasoning is a non sequitur. The conclusion or the consequent, no single bishop of Rome, only council of presbyters, doesn't necessarily follow from that antecedent, the use of we. Why? Well, because even in our own current Catholic example, when you have a secretary writing on behalf of the Vatican, the secretary in issuing some papal document could speak in the first person plural we or the Vatican, and that wouldn't mean there's no single current single bishop of Rome. Secondly, there are several examples in the Bible and in magisterial teaching where the first person plural we is used, and it doesn't entail a group of individuals issuing an authoritative decree, doesn't exclude having a single authoritative figure. Here's a few examples that make this clear. Take, for example, at the Council of Jerusalem in Acts 15, 10 through 11. Peter uses the plural we, the first person plural we, when he settles the theological dispute over whether circumcision is necessary to be a Christian. He states, "Now, therefore, why do you make trial of God by putting a yoke upon the neck of the disciples, which neither our fathers nor we have been able to bear? But we believe," notice, "we believe that we shall be saved through the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ, just as they will." The use of we here doesn't mean the definitive declaration is being given by the council of elders and apostles. Rather, it's Peter who's giving the declaration, and he's speaking on behalf of the church as a representative of the church as a whole. Not necessarily the 12 apostles, but the church as a whole, because that was the issue of debate. Luke makes that very clear. The issue that's being debated is whether the Gentiles need to be circumcised to be saved. And Peter declares no, and he speaks in the first person plural we. Paul used the plural we, first person plural we, when addressing the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 1:23 and 2 Corinthians 1:24. Yet, this didn't nullify his unique authority as an apostle over the Corinthians. Even Pope Pius XII uses we when he defines Mary's bodily assumption in Munificentissimus Deus. He writes this, "By the authority of our Lord Jesus Christ, of the blessed apostles Peter and Paul, and by our own authority, we pronounce, declare, and define it to be a divinely revealed dogma." Notice, we pronounce, declare, and define. Pius XII's use of we doesn't entail that the definition is given by a council of presbyters or bishops. Rather, he, Pius XII, gave the definition, like Peter at the Council of Jerusalem in Acts 15. Therefore, just because the letter to the Church of Corinth uses the first person plural we that doesn't mean there was no single bishop and that the Church of Rome was only being governed by a council of presbyters. So I do not think the first person plural, the use of the first person plural we, is a good reason to reject the idea that there was a single bishop governing the Church of Rome in the first century. So that's a negative approach, right? Just simply trying to show that it's a non sequitur to conclude that there is no single bishop and it's governed by a council of presbyters because the use of we. As I said, a secretary even currently can speak on behalf of the Pope, writing a document speaking of we and the Vatican, and that wouldn't mean there's no current single bishop. And then we actually have examples, both in the Bible and in magisterial teaching, where that first person plural we is used, and it doesn't entail that there's no single authoritative figure issuing the decree. The we, the first person plural, can be used to represent the whole, even though it's being issued by a single authoritative figure. And similarly, when we come to Clement's letter to the Church of Corinth, whether we date it in before AD 70, when Clement's a secretary, or later in the first century, when Clement's the Bishop of Rome, the use of we would not entail there's no single bishop. Now, as I mentioned, there's also a positive approach that we could take, or you might call it an offensive approach, and we're going to get to that on the other side of the break. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Catholic Reason. I'm Dr. Carlo Brusoy. Well, welcome back, my friends, to The Catholic Reason, a radio production of St. Michael Catholic Radio based in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. I'm Dr. Carlo Brusoy, staff apologist at Catholic Answers and a member of the Chancery Evangelization Team here at the Diocese of Tulsa in eastern Oklahoma. Today, we're looking at challenges to the early papacy. And so far, we dove right in into looking at a challenge from the use of the first person plural we in Clement's letter to the Church of Corinth. Some would argue that since the first person plural we is being used, that shows that there was no single bishop of Rome governing the Church of Rome in the first century. And we responded to that claim with a negative approach, just trying to show that the conclusion, no single bishop of Rome and is being governed by a council of presbyters, doesn't necessarily follow from the premise that the first person plural we is being used in the letter. And we spoke about how even currently in magisterial procedures, you can have a secretary of the Pope writing a letter on behalf of the Pope speaking with the first person plural we or the Vatican, and that wouldn't entail that there's currently no single bishop of Rome. And then secondly, we gave evidence from both scripture and in magisterial teaching where the first person plural we is used, and there is a single authoritative figure issuing the teaching or the declaration. We looked at Peter in Acts 15 at the Council of Jerusalem. We believe, but yet it's he who's taking the initiative to declare circumcision doesn't save, grace through faith saves. And then even Pope Pius XII in his definition of the bodily assumption, we pronounce, declare, and define. That doesn't mean there's no single bishop of Rome, right? He's speaking on behalf of the church, but yet he is the one issuing the definition. And so I do not think that the use of the first person plural we in Clement's letter to the Church of Corinth is a good reason to reject the idea that there was a single bishop of Rome in the first century and conclude that it's only governed by a council of presbyters. Now, before the break, I mentioned that there's also a positive approach that we can take in response to this challenge to the early papacy, and that involves providing positive arguments that the Church of Rome would have been governed by a single bishop in the first century. So the dialectic would be, the challenge is, it's the letter uses we, so therefore no single bishop. We respond and say, no, that's a non sequitur. Just because we is used, that doesn't mean no single bishop. But then the question arises, well, is there any evidence or any arguments that we could put forward to, in a positive way, to establish the claim that there would be a single bishop of Rome in the first century, during the time when Clement's letter is issued to the Church of Corinth, even if it's before AD 70. Well, one argument would be from early source attestation. Some early sources attest to a succession of bishops in the bishopric of Rome from St. Peter on, and such attestation is never contested in the early church. So consider Irenaeus's account in his work Against Heresies, where he writes, and this would be, let's see if I have the citation here. This would be Book 3, Chapter 3. So here's what Irenaeus says. The blessed apostles then, having founded and built up the church, committed into the hands of Linus the office of the episcopate. Of this Linus, Paul makes mention in the epistles to Timothy. To him succeeded Anacletus, and after him in the third place from the apostles, Clement was allotted the bishopric. That's the Clement to whom the letter to the Church of Corinth is attributed. This man, as he had seen the blessed apostles and had been conversant with them, might be said to have the preaching of the apostles still echoing in his ears and the traditions before his eyes. To this Clement, there succeeded Evaristus. Alexander followed Evaristus, then sixth from the apostles, Sixtus was appointed. After him, Telephorus, who was gloriously martyred, then Hyginus, after him, Pius, then after him, Anicetus, Soter, having succeeded Anicetus, Eleutherius does now in the 12th place, Irenaeus says, from the apostles, hold the inheritance of the episcopate. Hegesippus, who writes anywhere from AD 150 to 180, is another early father who speaks about the succession of the bishops in Rome. His comments are recorded by Eusebius in his Ecclesiastical History, Book 4, Chapter 22. Here's what we read. On my arrival at Rome, this is Eusebius recording Hegesippus. He writes this, on my arrival at Rome, I drew up a list of the succession of bishops down to Anicetus, whose deacon was Eleutherus. To Anicetus succeeded Soter, and after him came Eleutherus. But in the case of every succession and in every city, the state of affairs is in accordance with the teaching of the law and of the prophets and of the Lord. Given this evidence, a Protestant can't claim that the early Church of Rome was governed by a council of presbyters without saying that Irenaeus and Hegesippus and Eusebius were either factually wrong or made up this idea of succession of bishops in the Church of Rome, both of which seems quite implausible. Now, a Protestant may just dig his feet in and hold to the claim that these early sources were just plain wrong. If that's the case, well then, we can challenge that claim by pointing out a potential double standard. This argument is made by Catholic apologist Swan Sona in his interview with Trent Horn in the episode of Horn's podcast entitled, Did the Early Church Have Popes? With Swan Sona. And if I'm mispronouncing Swan's name, I apologize. Consider that most Protestants acknowledge, on account of the unanimous view of the fathers, that the Clement to whom the letter is attributed is the same Clement that Paul speaks of in Philippians chapter 4, verse 3. For example, Irenaeus speaks of Clement as one who had seen the blessed apostles, had been conversant with them, and might be said to have the preaching of the apostles still echoing in his ears and their traditions before his eyes. So that's Irenaeus testifying to this Clement being the one that Paul knew. Origen also affirms that Clement was a disciple of the apostles in his first principles, 2.3.6. So I think that would be Book 2, Chapter 3. Eusebius, in his Ecclesiastical History, Book 3, Chapter 4, makes explicit that Clement is the one spoken of in Philippians 4, 3. He writes this, as to the rest of his followers, Paul testifies that Crescens was sent to Gaul, but Linus, whom he mentions in the second epistle to Timothy and his companion at Rome, was Peter's successor in the episcopate of the church there, as has already been shown. Clement also, who was appointed third bishop of the church at Rome, was, as Paul testifies, his co-laborer and fellow soldier. So notice there Eusebius affirming the succession of St. Peter in the bishopric of Rome right there in the first century. But here, to our purposes, he's affirming that Clement is the one that is spoken of by Paul in Philippians 4:3. Now, if a Protestant accepts Irenaeus' testimony about Clement, well then, why would he deny Irenaeus' testimony about the succession of the bishops in the Church of Rome, or Eusebius' testimony there that I just read about the succession of the bishops in Rome in the first century? To simply assert he's wrong without evidence, that is, if to assert Irenaeus is wrong without evidence, and at the same time say he's right when it comes to Clement being the one that Paul speaks of in Philippians 4, is just special pleading. Using Irenaeus as a legitimate testimony when it comes to who Clement is, but in this special case of the succession of the bishops, without reason, not using Irenaeus as a legitimate testimony, that would be special pleading. Now, another argument for there being a single bishop of Rome in the first century, so our first argument was early source attestation. Irenaeus, Hegesippus, and then Eusebius as well. So we have multiple early source attestation. Now, another argument for there being a single bishop of Rome in the first century is that it's highly improbable for there to be such a drastic change of church government without any sort of criticism. Consider that by the time of Ignatius of Antioch, whose letters date to about AD 107, part and parcel of Christian belief is that a bishop is necessary to even have a church. Here's what Ignatius writes in chapter 3 of his letter to the Trillians. In like manner, let all reverence the deacons as an appointment of Jesus Christ and the bishop as Jesus Christ, who is the Son of the Father, and the presbyters as the Sanhedrin of God and assembly of the apostles. Apart from these, there is no church. Notice, apart from the bishop, the presbyters, and the deacons, there is no church. For Ignatius, this belief concerning the relation between a bishop and the church doesn't seem to be a novelty, which means the belief itself would date prior to the end of the first century, within the last decade, 90 to 100. So if this belief wasn't present at the time of Clement's letter, circa AD 70, before the destruction of the Jerusalem, and there wasn't a single bishop of Rome giving legitimacy to the Church of Rome, well then, we'd have a major addition or an accretion to Christian theology, merely 20 years or so after Clement's letter. Now, this isn't impossible, but is highly improbable. And here's the reason why. Clement's letter was written to the Corinthian church in the first place because of sedition against the Corinth presbyters. Whenever the Christian understanding of proper church government is threatened, it becomes public and it's dealt with. And we see reference of this in Jude 1:11 and the rebellion of Korah. I'm going to come back to this on the other side of the break. I have to hit the pause button. Friends, don't go anywhere. You're listening to The Catholic Reason. Talk to you on the other side of the break. Well, welcome back, my friends, to The Catholic Reason. If you're just joining me, I'm Dr. Carlo Broussard, staff apologist and speaker for Catholic Answers at Catholic.com and a member of the Chancery Evangelization Team at the Diocese of Tulsa and Eastern Oklahoma. In today's episode, we're looking at challenges to the early papacy. And so far in today's episode, we've been looking at one particular challenge that appeals to Clement's letter to the Church of Corinth, which some scholars date to before the destruction of Jerusalem, about AD 69 to 70, because there's evidence in the letter that seems to suggest the temple is still standing. And there's two things to consider there. There's the use of the first person plural, we, and that it's being written when Clement was only a secretary of sorts and not the Bishop of Rome. And for some, that's evidence that there was no single Bishop of Rome in the first century Church of Rome. And so therefore, we don't have the Catholic argument that the papacy was present there in the first century falls apart, because in order for that to be, you need a single bishop of Rome. Now, we've provided a negative approach to that challenge, showing that it's a non sequitur. Just because you have the first person plural we being used, it doesn't necessarily follow that there's no single bishop of Rome. And in our last segment, we started offering a positive approach, that is to say, to provide arguments as to why we can conclude that there would have been a single bishop of Rome in the first century, even at the time of Clement being a secretary before the destruction of Jerusalem. And one argument that we provided was early source attestation. Irenaeus attests to a succession of bishops in the bishopric of Rome. Hegesippus attests to an early succession of the bishops in Rome. And of course, Eusebius does as well. And we provided that evidence. Now, another argument that we began to look at before the end of our last segment, and we came up on that break, was that Ignatius of Antioch teaches right at the turn of the second century that a bishop is necessary for there to be a church. So if that is something that it was not the case for the Church of Rome and for Christian churches before the destruction of Jerusalem, then merely right at 20 years after Clement's letter to the church in Corinth, you would have a major accretion to Christian theology. You would have a drastic change in the Christian understanding of church government and the structure thereof. And as I was mentioning before the break, that sort of drastic change isn't impossible, but it's highly improbable. And the reason is because we have evidence that then when there is a drastic change or an undermining of a proper understanding of church governance, there's going to be a big stink about it. And Clement's letter testifies to that. The reason for Clement's letter in the first place was because of, quote, a sedition against the Corinth presbyters, close quote. That's from chapter 47 of Clement's letter. Whenever the Christian understanding of proper church government is threatened, it became public, and it would become public, and it was dealt with, and it would be dealt with, right? And at the end of the last break, I referenced very quickly Jude's reference to the first century Christians falling into the rebellion of Korah, and how that's evidence for this idea in Jude 1:11. Jude says some have fallen into the rebellion of Korah, which refers to the book of Numbers, where Korah rebels against Moses and Aaron's improper priestly rank. And Jude is saying that there are some in the New Testament Christian church that are falling into that error, thereby implying that they're rebelling against proper rank of authority. So whenever there's an undermining of proper authority, there's going to be something. Somebody's going to say something about it. So if Ignatius's theology of the bishop and the bishop being necessary for there to be a church, and the bishop's relation to the church, if that were a novelty conflicting with the ancient Christian belief, someone would have made a stink about it. But there's nothing of the sort. And for this reason, it's highly improbable that Ignatius's theology of the bishop and his relation to the church is an accretion to Christian theology. It's more reasonable to think that it's part and parcel of the Christian tradition. And if that's so, then we have reason to think that a bishop would have been governing the Church of Rome at the time of Clement's letter, even before the destruction of Jerusalem. Accord with what Irenaeus says and Eusebius says, that Linus would have been the bishop at that time, the bishop of Rome. And so that completes our response to the first challenge by the appeal to the use of we in Clement's letter to the Church of Corinth. A second challenge to the early papacy is that Ignatius doesn't mention a bishop of Rome in his letter to the Romans. Speaking of Ignatius, right? In his appearance on the Cameron Bertuzzi show, Capturing Christianity, Protestant apologist Jerry Walls puts the argument like this. He said, what's fascinating is in these seven letters of Ignatius, there's like at least 40 references to the bishop. I mean, he's really obsessed, you might say, with episcopal power, with the bishop's authority and the like. But here's what's fascinating, Wall says. All of these 40 or so references to the bishop and the importance of his authority occur just in six of the letters. There's only one of them where you don't have a mention of a bishop. The letter written to Rome is the one where there's no bishop mentioned. Other churches, he mentions the bishop. But in Rome, where you supposedly have a bishop of Rome, bishop of bishops, he says, residing, he doesn't mention a bishop. Walls continues, I think the way he talks about the bishop in the other six letters is precisely what leads you to think if there were a bishop in Rome, especially a bishop as important as Roman Catholics say, he would certainly be mentioned. Now, the majority of my responses to Wall's challenge here are nothing new. I don't want to claim any sort of new responses here. I'm simply pulling from a variety of fellow Catholic apologists that I would recommend that you check out. So check out an episode of Trent Horn's podcast at Catholic.com entitled Answering the Strongest Argument Against Catholicism. Also, Horn interviewed Catholic YouTuber and apologist Swan Sona. I mentioned him earlier, and that's entitled Did the Early Church Have a Pope with Swan Sona? And finally, Horn interviewed Joe Heschmeyer, another colleague of mine at Catholic Answers, on the same topic, and the episode title was There a First Century Bishop of Rome? And Joe Heschmeyer also came out with an episode of his own podcast, Shameless Popery, where he deals with this issue as well, and you can check that out at Catholic.com. So I'm just kind of pulling from all what my colleagues and friends have said and trying to synthesize it for you, my listeners and my viewers. Now, so one response to Walls's challenge is that Walls's challenge from silence is arbitrarily selective. For example, Ignatius doesn't mention anything about presbyters or deacons in Rome. So the question becomes, must we conclude that there are no presbyters, deacons, or Christians in Rome? Well, Walls's logic would have us conclude yes. He said Ignatius doesn't mention the Bishop of Rome, and so therefore there must not be a Bishop of Rome. But Ignatius doesn't mention presbyters, deacons in Rome either. And so according to that logic, we would have to conclude there are no presbyters and deacons in the Church of Rome. But that's a conclusion that neither Walls nor any other Protestant would agree with, since they commonly argue that the Church of Rome was being governed not by a single bishop, but by a council of elders or presbyters there at the time of Clement's letter. And even in the first and the beginning, at the time of Ignatius writing to the Church of Rome. So that Ignatius doesn't mention the Bishop of Rome in his letter to the Romans doesn't prove there is no Bishop of Rome. The lack of that mentioning doesn't give evidence that there's no Bishop of Rome. A second response is that we have reason to believe that Ignatius would have believed a Bishop of Rome to be present in Rome. So we can actually argue from Ignatius's other letters that he would have thought a Bishop of Rome was there. One line of evidence is what we've already seen. Ignatius clearly teaches in his letters that a bishop is necessary to even have a church. Remember his letter to the Trillians. Apart from these, deacons, bishop, and presbyters, there is no church. Now, Ignatius views the community in Rome to be a church, like those who are the subjects of his other letters. He makes this clear in the prologue of his letter to the Roman church. He writes, Ignatius, who is also called Theophorus, to the church which has obtained mercy through the majesty of the Most High Father and Jesus Christ, his only begotten Son, the church, which is beloved and enlightened by the will of him that willeth all things which are according to the love of Jesus Christ our God, which also presides in the place of the region of the Romans. Notice, the church, which is beloved and enlightened by the will of him that is Jesus Christ. No commentary here is needed on this passage. It's clear. Ignatius believed the Church of Rome to be a church, like the other churches that he mentions in his other letters that require a bishop to make it a church. Since Ignatius believes a bishop is necessary to have a church, and he views the community of Christians in Rome to be a church, and a model one at that, it follows that Ignatius would have believed the Church of Rome to have a bishop, even though he doesn't mention the bishop. Another reason why we can reasonably think Ignatius would have believed a bishop to be present there in the Church of Rome is that he speaks of bishops being settled everywhere among the churches. Check out what he writes in his letter to the Ephesians in chapter 3. As also bishops settled everywhere to the utmost bounds of the earth are so by the will of Jesus Christ. Bishops settled everywhere to the utmost bounds of the earth by the will of Jesus Christ. Here, Ignatius says that the bishops were present in the churches everywhere. Wouldn't the Church of Rome be included in that category? I think it's reasonable to say yes. Why would there be bishops in all the churches throughout the bounds of the earth by the will of Jesus Christ except for the Church of Rome? That just doesn't make sense. So given that Ignatius believes bishops are settled everywhere, we can reasonably conclude that he would have believed there to be a single bishop of Rome in the Church of Rome when he's writing that letter, along with his teaching that in order to have a church, which the Church of Rome is, you need a bishop. My friends, I'm coming up on our next break. Stay tuned. Talk to you on the other side. Well, welcome back to our last and final segment of today's episode of The Catholic Reason, a radio production of St. Michael Catholic Radio based here in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. Friends, in today's episode, we've been looking at challenges to the early papacy. We looked at one challenge from Clement's letter to the Church of Corinth, where it uses the first person plural we. And for many, that is evidence that the Church of Rome in the first century, at the time the letter was written, which some scholars put before the destruction of the temple about AD 69 to 70, was not governed by a single bishop of Rome, but merely a council of presbyters. We gave reasons why that detail does not prove and is not reasonable evidence for the conclusion that it was not governed by a single bishop of Rome, but only a council of presbyters. And then we gave an argument as to why we would be able to conclude and reasonably think, historically speaking, that there would have been a single bishop of Rome governing the Church of Rome at the time Clement's letter was written, even if we put it before the destruction of Jerusalem. And we have early source attestation of that. We have Irenaeus attesting to it, Hegesippus attesting to it, Eusebius attesting to succession of bishops in the bishopric of Rome, even at the time of within the first century. Now, in our last segment, we were looking at another challenge to the early papacy from Ignatius's letter to the Roman Church. Some Protestants, one in particular, Protestant apologist Jerry Walls, argues that Ignatius's lack of mentioning of a bishop of Rome in his letter to the Roman Church is evidence that there was no single bishop of Rome, even at the turn of the second century when Ignatius is writing this letter to the Church of Rome, like there were bishops for other churches. And so we began to respond to that sort of challenge. Number one, it's arbitrarily selective in its logic, saying that there's no single bishop of Rome because Ignatius doesn't mention a bishop of Rome, but yet Ignatius also doesn't mention presbyters or deacons, and so there and Protestants do not conclude that there were no presbyters or deacons in the Church of Rome. And so the logic is arbitrarily selective there, applying the logic to the bishop of Rome, but not applying that same standard or logic when it comes to presbyters and deacons. Secondly, we have reasons to believe that Ignatius would have thought there is a single bishop of Rome in the Roman Church when he's writing this letter. Number one, Ignatius teaches that it's part and parcel of Christian belief that church government involves bishops, and that in order to have a legitimate church, you need a bishop. And of course, Ignatius views the Roman Church to be a church like the other churches that have bishops. And so therefore, it's reasonable to conclude that he would have thought the Church of Rome had a single bishop. He would have believed that. And then secondly, Ignatius teaches and mentions in his letters that bishops were settled everywhere to the utmost bounds of the earth by the will of Jesus Christ, which reasonably would have included the Church of Rome. Why would every single other church have a bishop to make it a church, but this particular church in Rome not have a bishop, which is necessary to be a church? That doesn't make sense. And so for that reason, we can conclude that Ignatius would have believed that there was a single bishop of Rome. Now, we came up to our break in our last segment, and at this point in the conversation, the question arises, Well, why would Ignatius not mention the Bishop of Rome? So we've given reasons why to think that Ignatius would have believed the Church of Rome to have a Bishop of Rome. But if that's the case, if he believed there was a single Bishop of Rome governing the Church of Rome and he writes his letter to the Church of Rome, why doesn't he mention the bishop in his letter to the Romans? Well, friends, there are two plausible reasons for this kind of silence. First, Ignatius has different reasons for writing the Church of Rome compared to the other churches. For example, as my colleague and friend Trent Horn points out in his podcast episode on this issue, his letters, Ignatius's letters to the other churches, involve correctives that were meant to solve problems that were arising within those communities, like disobedience to the bishop. That's why he has to hammer it. Stay true to the bishop. Obey the bishop. This is why Ignatius is adamant about obeying the bishop of the churches throughout his letters, right? In the other churches that he's writing to. His letter to the Church of Rome, however, historically different, noticeably so. He lavishes the church with praises, which he doesn't do as much for the other churches. So, for example, he says, to the church which is beloved and enlightened by the will of him that willeth all things, which also presides in the place of the region of the Romans, worthy of God, worthy of honor, worthy of the highest happiness, worthy of praise, worthy of obtaining her every desire, worthy of being deemed holy, and which presides over love. That's some lavishing language there. Giving these praises, there doesn't seem to be a need for correctives, such as correction about obeying the bishop, like it was for the other churches. And if there's no need to offer correctives concerning obedience to the bishop in the Church of Rome, well, then it's reasonable Ignatius's letter to Rome would lack this sort of instruction about church authority. The bottom line is, there's no need to talk about obedience to the bishop because that's not a problem in the Church of Rome. Apparently so. Another difference in this letter to the Roman Church, as opposed to the other churches, is that Ignatius requests prayers from the other churches for him to endure his martyrdom, whereas for the Christians in Rome, he's asking that they not interfere with his martyrdom. This is another difference. Again, a different purpose for writing can explain a difference in the content of the letter, like the inclusion or exclusion of structures of church government. Given these different reasons for writing the letter to the Church of Rome, it's not necessary to expect Ignatius to talk about a bishop being in Rome like he does for the other churches. Again, a different purpose involves different content. And it is clear that there is a different purpose for which he's writing this letter to the Roman Church in comparison to the letters that he writes to other churches. Now, a second plausible reason for Ignatius's silence about the Bishop of Rome is that he doesn't want to expose the Bishop of Rome to undue persecution. Remember, Ignatius is an imperial prisoner who's being publicly shown to Christians in Rome what will happen to them if they resist the demands of Caesar. An exposed Bishop of Rome would have led to a shared fate. And this was not a concern, however, for Onesimus, say, Bishop of Ephesus, which possibly explains why Ignatius felt free to mention Onesimus in his letter to the Ephesians. Ignatius also feels free to mention Bishop Damas in his letter to the Magnesians. He writes, to the Magnesians, Damas, your most worthy bishop. This is also perhaps the reason why Ignatius doesn't mention any names of Christians, presbyters, or deacons. Yet he does so in his other letters. For example, in the previous mentioned letter to the Magnesians, Ignatius mentions the presbyters Bassus and Apollonius and the deacon Sodio. So we have plausible reasons here to explain Ignatius's lack of reference to the Bishop of Rome. And that in turn gives us reason not to think that Ignatius's lack of reference proves there was no Bishop of Rome in the early church. And of course, those reasons being that Ignatius had a different purpose for writing his letter to the Roman church than he did for his letters to the other churches. Clearly, the other churches were having problems with obedience to the bishop, and so he has to offer correctives to those other churches to get them to obey their bishop, hence the reason why he's so adamant about the bishop being necessary for a church. And for the letter to the Church of Rome, given the lavishing language and the praise, high praises he gives to the church, apparently there was no problem when it came to obedience to the bishop of Rome. Hence, there's no need to talk about the necessity of a bishop to have a church and church government structure. And then secondly, Ignatius doesn't want to expose the bishop of Rome to undue persecution. So those are plausible reasons as to why Ignatius would not mention the bishop of Rome in his letter to the Roman church. So like our first argument with Clement's letter to the Church of Corinth, we can't conclude no single bishop of Rome based upon we. Well, here with Ignatius's letter to the Roman church, it's unreasonable to conclude no single bishop of Rome based on the premise that he doesn't mention the bishop of Rome. It's just a non sequitur. The conclusion doesn't follow from the premises. Well, my friends, that's all the time we have for this week's episode of The Catholic Reason. My claim today was that the evidence that Protestants put forward to argue the early Church of Rome wasn't governed by a single bishop, a monarchical bishop, doesn't justify a rejection of the papacy existing in the early church. The reasons provided in Clement's letter to the Church of Corinth and Ignatius's lack of mentioning the Bishop of Rome does not give justification for rejecting the Catholic claim that the papacy existed with Peter and beyond, and that there were successors to St. Peter in the bishopric of Rome, and that the Church of Rome was indeed governed by a single bishop. Thanks for listening to The Catholic Reason, a production of St. Michael Catholic Radio, based here in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. Remember, you can download the show through whichever podcast platform that you use by subscribing to the Eastern Oklahoma Catholic Podcast. And remember, you can access the archived episodes also on my website at carlobroussard.com under the audio tab. Be sure to check out all my work there at my website. I invite you to join me again next week for The Catholic Reason as we continue to look at Catholic claims and the reasons behind them. Tell a friend. I'll talk to you then. God bless.